What is Christian asceticism? My name is Matthew Lee Anderson, and you are listening to another episode of Mere Fidelity, the podcast where we think together about the Word of God and the world we live in. This episode of Mere Fidelity is brought to you by our friends at Lexham Press. You can still get, there's still time to get the February Lexham Press Book of the Month at lexhampress.com/mere fidelity. You can get 40% off the Ten Commandments, text written by Harold Sankbill, art by Natasha Kennedy. This is a beautiful book, really wonderful. Do get a copy, 40% off on that. Shout out as well to the merry band of patron supporters. If you want to join the crew, you can do so through mirrorfidelity.com. And I also wanted to alert folks to the fact that Davenant House, our friends there, their courses, their spring courses are now filling, and you can join the crew. Alistair is doing a course. Alistair, what is your course that you are teaching for them?
It's on the subject of man and woman in modernity.
Man and woman in
modernity.
Modernity.
So I recently taught a course on a biblical theology of the sexes, which was focusing upon the biblical treatment of man and woman. And this is a complementary course, which gets into questions of the current context and its particular challenges, where those have arisen from, and how as Christians we can speak faithfully into them. So we'll be dealing with many questions that we've dealt with on this show before, and a number besides.
Alistair, I'm very disappointed that you missed the joke there, that you had taught a course on the biblical view, and now you're teaching a course on the unbiblical view. That's the joke that was there for the making. Davenant Hall, you can go to davenanthall.com to register for that and for other courses. Joe Minich, who's been on the podcast before, is teaching one on philosophy as a way of life. They've got a class on 1st and 2nd Corinthians. You can get a discount, MF Trinity 24, MF for Mere Fidelity, Trinity 24. If this is your first time auditing a course through davenanthall.com, you can get a discount on those courses. So make sure you do that. We wanted to alert you to what our friends and Alistair are up to over at Davenant Hall. So guys, we've all gotten through Ash Wednesday successfully, more or less successfully. This is not a show about Lent.
Wait, there was Ash Wednesday?
Derek, yeah. What's that?
Must inform the Presbyterian on the show.
The Presbyterians.
Wait, what happened?
What happened? Presbyterians do not observe.
That's not true. Many of them do.
Many of them do. This is not a show about Lent. We did a show about Lent 7 years ago. And I know that because a listener tagged me saying that they were listening to the podcast from 7 years ago.
Wow.
And it turns out that I'm just still saying the same thing 7 years later. So if you're new to the show in the last 7 years, you know, you can go back to hear what we thought 7 years ago about Lent. But this is not a show about Lent per se. I wanted to talk about asceticism, because asceticism is, it's a subspecies of Lent. It's a, what should we call it, right? Like it shows up during Lent, but it's much broader than that. It's a form of life. It's a manner of practicing the Christian life that has been controversial in church history. Guys, here's a detail about my intellectual life that I don't think I have ever shared, which is that the first thing I ever wrote for a public audience was in a little student newsletter at Torrey Honors College. And I wrote it on asceticism, on St. Anthony in the Desert and the spiritual fathers, and whether or not asceticism could be incorporated into a responsible Christian account of the world. So this is reaching deep into my intellectual roots.
The intellectual origins of Matt quitting Netflix is
me reading St. Anthony as an undergrad.
It's actually St. Anthony. The Life of St. Anthony.
Yeah.
In Torrey. Wow.
I think no one is surprised to hear that that's the case. But it's true. So I have lots of thoughts about asceticism and why it's awesome, and every Christian should obviously be an ascetic in one realm or the other. But
Matt, explain the term. What does the term ascesis mean in its first basic? For those of us who are lowbrow and don't know what it
who
means.
Who knows what it means?
What is it?
I don't know what it means. No, I take ascesis to be a form of discipline, a set of practices in which one is trying to discipline one's whole life, but which historically have centered on the body and reshaping one's bodily practices in such ways that it goes awry and has sometimes been construed as a fight against the body, as though the body itself were the locus of these illegitimate or problematic desires, these sinful desires that one is trying to expunge. I don't think that that's what asceticism is, but it does center on the body. So the body is a real question mark within it, such that when Paul writes about buffeting his body, that's a very crucial text for asceticism as a disposition within the Christian life. Derek, does that pass muster at all?
Yeah. So what I want to ask then is it fundamentally defined as kind of generalized practices of self-denial with respect to bodily kind of impulses for some end, et cetera, et cetera? I mean, obviously there's discipline involved, but ascesis, are there other forms of ascesis that are not bodily oriented or are maybe more positively construed, right? Is there a positive ascesis or is it primarily a negative moment?
I think there is such a thing as positive ascesis. And my friends who think a lot about this will really underscore that. I think asceticism historically has meant the negative dimension, that what comes to mind is the self-denial, the practices of fasting, the practices of denying other types of desires that are rooted in one sense in the body or that have some sort of bodily dimension to them. And it's hard to think of a desire that doesn't have a bodily dimension to it, right? Like we live in our bodies, we can't escape that. But I think asceticism is, my image of it is predominantly negative in that way. It's predominantly a form of discipline that is self-denying, such that Paul's language about buffeting the body, right? Like really, like it's not indulging, like feasting, right? While there is a sort of appropriate ascesis of feasting, such that you have to, I think, learn rightly to enjoy God's good creation, and that includes participating in God's good creation by eating feasts at appropriate times and whatnot, that's not really what asceticism is at its heart, because those are, in one respect, for some people, easier disciplines to take up. Now, for ascetically minded people, actually, feasting might be very hard to do, right? It could be very hard for certain types of people to really indulge in celebratory moments because they're just not inclined to see the world in those sorts of positive ways, which is its own set of pathologies, dysfunctions. But I think asceticism is predominantly negative in that way.
So when we're thinking about the negative character of asceticism, is it something that needs, as a correlate, a positive practice in order to function as it ought to? So for instance, giving up these things of the body in order to give yourself more fully to the life of prayer. It seems to me that the danger would be that you have this negative impulse against the body and the things of the body, that without this positive correlate will tend towards a sort of dysfunctional spirituality of the kind that Paul discusses elsewhere in his epistles.
Mm-hmm. I think that seems to be right. But the positive is, for instance, I think like fasting, right? So Jesus' line in Matthew 4 about man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God, right? Like there's a negative and a positive that's contained within that particular line, right? Which is that you don't live by bread alone. Now there's a positive that's buried in there, which is you live by bread, but it's not by bread alone. And that's the negative, right? So there's some sort of intimation that actually you should, like you could go without bread, provided that you have the positive word of God, that actually what you're living by is the word of God. And so the ascetical practices of fasting are only Christian insofar as they are encounters with the positive word of God, the deepening of one's relationship to the word of God, or deepening with one's relationship to God through prayer and these other sorts of means of nourishment. But what I think I want to defend is the impulse in the first place that the self-denial like the impulse to deny oneself in the first place. Because I actually think that most Christians or many Christians struggle to get their heads around that as a regular part of the Christian, right? Like it seems sort of perverse or world denying or just dysfunctional. And I think actually it's the right sort of impulse to have.
One aspect of it would be when Paul talks about the disciplining of his body, he relates it to the work of an athlete. An athlete is not denying the physical realm. Indeed, they're seeking to be more focused and effective within that physical realm. And so the denial is maybe a practice for the sake of a greater focus and awareness and activity within that realm, not just a dislodging of oneself from it.
I mean, this is one of those things where fasting is all over the place right now. Intermittent fasting, if you follow enough of the health discussions and the, you know, everybody's doing keto, everybody's intermittent fasting. There's all sorts of science on, well, hey, that's helpful for insulin resistance and so on and so forth. And for our culture, you know, there's a lot of, you know, potential benefits as just a health practice. But what's interesting is if you follow some of these health influencers and the discussions around that, there is a lot of spiritual, there's a spiritual dimension to a lot of the conversation that folks in that world have around self-denial, around intermittent fasting. Is the ones who are kind of been doing it for a while, they'll start talking actually about not just, hey, losing weight, not just this, but actually like evaluating your relationship to food and the way it taps into your emotional responses and healthy eating. So it's just been interesting to see that world kind of re-engage some of these practices, mindfulness, fasting, dopamine fasting, refraining from all these things as a way of gaining self-knowledge, self-mastery, and recalibrating. And at the same time, falling prey to the exact same pathologies we've seen in Christian history, tendencies towards self-righteousness, pride, extreme forms of this, just the relative condemnation of folks who can't, who struggle, who the in and of itselfness of self-mastery, right? Which so that there's a way of getting into all, there's people who can really deny themselves. They're awesome at denying themselves all sorts of small particular pleasures or whatever it is, all in pursuit of one grand excess, which is the self. It's as a matter of pursuing some other fleshly desire, as Paul talks about. There's this level of like the inflation of your own ego and your own conception as someone who has mastered their own desires, mastered themselves, the self-contained man or I don't mm-hmm. know, but, yeah, high athlete. So
Derek, I think that's exactly right on the sort of upper middle class side of things, right? But there's also a version of that that is the highly online young male sort of spectrum.
We're
getting shredded or whatever the term is, swole. What are the terms these days?
Swole's old, man. Swole's old. I mean, there's Jack, there's Rip, there's...
Whatever the term is, right? Yeah. But we're indulging...
Shredded is...
Too old. Yeah, that outed me as an old person. But this vision of bodies as tight, taut, male bodies particularly, right? Where you're sort of have... honed your muscles in such a way, all of that is wrapped up in a kind of asceticism that is really, I think, pathological. And one of the questions that I have about sort of the world is the ways, like whether or not those types of alternate spiritualities of the body have taken hold, not because evangelicals haven't thought or talked about the body per se, but because they actually don't have practices of asceticism that have been inculcated in communities as ways of forming bodies to be vectors of love for God and love for the world, rather than vectors of upper middle class feel-goodism or political resistance to the longhouse, to use the version on the right. I just said a phrase or a cultural illusion that I hope none of our audience actually understands, but I think probably people do. Right. Cultural.
Far too many. Far too many. Yeah.
Political resistance to the forms of modernity that have hollowed out maleness as such. That, like, there's a way in which I'm sympathetic with a kind of asceticism in response to modernity, Alistair, talking about male and female and modernity. But it seems like that vision of modernity on both sides takes hold precisely because Christians have not had an alternate asceticism that we have been able to inculcate in our communities and Christian lives. Is that, Alistair, is that a sympathy or like a plausible reading of the world? Are you sympathetic with that at all?
I think that's an element of it. I think one aspect of asceticism that Paul gets into that we haven't really mentioned so far is a relationship with the law. The sort of do not do this, do not do that. And that, I think, is part of the appeal for many people. It's a code. It gives a structure. It gives a sense of control. If you're able to order your life in terms of a very strict regimen, it gives you a sense of order when you might otherwise feel disorder. And that can be a source of security for people. And you see this in very pathological forms in certain eating disorders, but you also see it in less obviously pathological forms in some of these approaches to the body that are the sort of gamified, extreme focus upon the calories that you're taking in, the amount that you're doing in various lifting, how many miles you're running each day, steps you're walking, etc., etc. And that sort of legalistic way of living has a great deal of appeal, particularly for those of us who are used to the measured life, the life that has all these numbers and figures and various criteria against which we're measuring ourselves. And so I think that aspect that you've discussed, the aspect of lacking a healthy form of asceticism, that's certainly part of the picture. I think there's also a sort of relationship with law as such that Christians always have to think about, but I think we can see some of that pathological form in many of the current regnant practices.
I want to say this, some of this is a, you know, so I'm someone who's grown up in the gym since I was like 13 or 14, and I worked at them, you know, football, lifting, all that kind of
You're
stuff.
You're swole, Olympic. We get it, Derek, you know.
No. I'm someone who's also had several years of severe pain, pathology, unable to do these sorts of things, having to climb out of that whole chronic pain, whatever. But the other element of this is that, you know, the appealing part of it is it's often a reaction against chaos, right? So this is the classic, hey, clean up your room. Like people are like, oh, Jordan Peterson pushing legalism, et cetera, et cetera. But for the kid who has had a house with no order, no vision, no direction, discipline can be liberating and meaning instilling, and actually just self-mastery can go bad, but also it can be giving people a basic sense of agency. Like when you're a young teenager and you're struggling with discipline, and somebody introduces you to the gym, and within 2 months you realize if I show up 3 to 4 days a week and I do this set pattern, I will see results. And this has carryover into all sorts of other areas of their lives. Like, well, if I apply myself in this way, I can maybe bring some more order to this part of my life and more order to this part of my life. And so, you know, law, you know, the whole dichotomy of law and chaos, the lords of law and lords of chaos, you know, legalism and antinomianism, we have also a major sector of our country that has absolutely no discipline in these areas and is suffering massive, massive health and emotional well-being effects. Because when there's no discipline in these areas, it's not just, oh, hey, my weight isn't ideal and I'm not fitting to external modes of beauty and that kind of stuff. There's emotional implications. There's all these sorts of things. And so, I mean, I get why people start down that road, find successes, and then start to go forward. All the while, the danger is there of... All the while, the danger is there of falling into that sort of... I know, yeah, the right-leaning kind of return to the Greeks of the valorization of the beauty of the male body that starts to get kind of weird kind of fast. And I say this as somebody who likes gyms, who likes lifting, who thinks it's fine to count some calories and to try and push your squat max or whatever it is. Like that that can be healthy. But I also know exactly how it can go bad. This is why you have young men who are suffering from body dysmorphic disorder in ways that they weren't 15 to 20 years ago. And you'll see them in gym online forums joking about how their physique is trash. And it's guys who are cute, like built compared to 99% of the population, extraordinarily fit, but their perception's warped. And we talk about female body dysmorphic disorder because it has been more dominant through things, bulimia, anorexia, but you know, manorexia, guys working to the point where they're in the gym so much, they cannot stop lifting even when they're putting severe stress on their joints, backs, things like long-term health benefit, because they can't stop. So there's all sorts of ways this can go funny.
Sociologically, Derek, I think that it's worth pointing out that many of those changes. So, I mean, you pegged a lot of people who struggle with discipline and order in their lives. And I think that that's fair. We do have lots of people, but the sociological changes in America in the last 15 years, I mean, for men, we've talked about this with, on the show before, the shift in jobs that men do and the shifting sort of economic basis, like all of that means that physical labor isn't as prevalent within male communities. And that means that like workout culture can become a discrete thing. Whereas before, I think something like that was built into jobs and economies, and it was a sort of functional strength that people had to develop and subsequently a functional ordering of their lives. And so some of what I think is really interesting about these ascetical movements are the ways in which they are pressure release valves, seem to me to be pressure release valves for real impulses that are very deeply baked into the human experience that don't have outlets in our ordinary lives within our society as it's been set up and the way that it's been set up. But I also then don't want to, that has two effects for me. One, I think it means that I don't want to necessarily valorize the ascetical life in a way that we hold it up as heroic, because I think it's actually a kind of antidote to a certain set of perverse practices. But I also then don't want to unduly diminish or throw shade at or marginalize people who really struggle with the ascetic life, because I actually think they're also just acclimatized to communal situations and environmental conditions and ethos that is not conducive to ordering their lives effectively. As such, these forms of discipline and the like are genuinely heroic. Like we don't have cultures that produce it. So I think it's important to try to contextualize these things appropriately so as to not turn this form of life into something that it isn't.
One of the aspects of that that comes to mind is the fact that, as you mentioned, there's a sort of supplementary and medicinal character to a lot of these practices. And what are they substituting for? Often I think they're substituting for what would have in previous ages, which is the training of men for war, the expectation that men need to engage in struggle at some point in all likelihood in their lives. They're going to have to fight and they need to develop strength and ability at that. They also need to work tough physical jobs. We don't have to do those things anymore, so we need supplementary practices. And it seems also that there is something about the agonistic character of training for struggle and struggling in order to engage in some larger battle that is something that people need, particularly, I think, young men. And the ascetic struggle, I think, is part of that. It's a sense that training of the body, disciplining of the body, is for the end of a sort of deeper spiritual struggle. And maybe we don't think about the spiritual life in terms of struggle to the degree that we should, but that is very much part and parcel of the vision of asceticism in the early church. If you're thinking about St. Anthony or if you're thinking about others, it's the sense of the spiritual life as a battle. And maybe we just don't think about that enough And that would be the alternative to much that we have today, which maybe has too much of a vision of ease for the Christian life.
Yeah, St. Anthony and the Desert Fathers are out in the desert doing battle with the devil. That's why they're there. That's what the function of the Desert Fathers is, which I think is, to your point, Alistair. Derek, you were about to say?
No, I think that's absolutely right. I do think it's as with anything in the Christian life, you just have these tendencies to take things that are in and of themselves, either rooted in a created good, and then can be turned towards spiritual ends, but then taken on their own or aimed at the improper end can become pathological and demonic. And so there's a lot of young men, I think, a lot of young folks in general who, you know what, they would benefit from, again, going outside, touching grass, moving around, like getting some sunlight, et cetera, et cetera. And then that doesn't have to turn into nature worship / I live, you know, perpetually sunbathing, eating raw meat. Some of the Instagram influencers' lives are wild. But you can see how it can go bad if it's untethered from I'm doing these things in order to become a person who is more capable of loving people as best I can and having energy for and learning to be able to resist certain impulses and certain desires for the sake of higher ones, God, his kingdom, and so on and so forth. And I do say that with sensitivity, though, Matt, to what you're saying. I have people in my family who have long-term chronic pain issues. I had several years of chronic pain where just getting out of bed to stretch and like function was extraordinarily difficult. And so without looking at people and making snap judgments about where they are. And so this is why actually I kind of get anxious around Lenten practices in churches, because I know that there's some people who you start, hey, what are you going to give up for lunch? And some people can barely, they're barely scraping it to get to church on Sunday because of the pain, because of the exhaustion. And now you're telling me you have to cut out this, and oh gosh, I feel like I'm a terrible Christian because I need to eat food in the morning so I can take my medicine that I need to function and love my children, whatever it is. And so the adding of a burden to the already downcast is something that I think needs to be taken seriously for those churches that are trying to adopt this thing. And I would just, this is of that being aware that the adoption of Lent as a practice, in especially in traditions to which it's alien, that it's not just falling into, I'm sorry, the kind of upper middle class fetishism of hey, here's this new, it's another spiritual version of, hey, here's this new program, this new app I'm trying in order to, it can be that, you know, like, hey, I got an ad about this, and how if I take this pill, or if I have this meditation program or this routine, I'm going to optimize my life. And well, at Lent, that will help me optimize my spiritual life, because didn't you know the fathers, we discovered this ancient practice and it was hidden and blah, blah. And you can see how the commodification of it and the commercialization of it taps into that modern tendency where almost every retrieval, there's a danger of LARPing and fakeness around it. And so when you retrieve Lent in a context where you haven't been doing it for 1,000 years under threat of divine judgment, it can have that danger of both cheapening as well as commodifying, as well as condemning, and turning it into another form of works righteousness, right? And so, yeah, I at the end of the day, I'm starting to come out like an old school Presbyterian on some of this stuff. Like some of that's, there's something there.
I think that's right, Derek. But this is why I think, like, Paul's line about, I will not be mastered by anything.
Yeah.
Right. Is a really interesting line. And I brought this up recently in the context of coffee to someone, and how we read this line from Paul, but no one ever wants to apply it to coffee. And the number of people in evangelical contexts who are wholly willing to make jokes about how they're mastered by coffee and cannot function without it it's just fascinating to me. And this person said, oh, I could quit at any point. I'm not mastered. And I think the point of Lent is prove it, right? Like actually show that you are not mastered by this thing. But I actually think that asceticism should be something more than just giving up those things that you feel mastered by. So if you feel mastered by social media and you quit social media for a season, that's not quite asceticism on my book. Asceticism is the denial of goods that you might not be mastered by, but that giving up would be painful to you just because they're goods. And renouncing goods for the sake of experiencing betters is central to growth in charity and love within the Christian life. And that's that like good-better relationship that seems to me to lie at the heart of ascetical practices, not actually a relationship between what's sinful and not sinful, right? Or I'm mastered by these sinful desires and I'm quelling these inclinations. I think actually like there's a point where asceticism has purchase on that very clearly. I think that's right. But I actually think it's also this self-abnegation, this denial of goods for the sake of betters, which is why I think it should have actually the most purchase on those who are of sound health, mind, body within churches, right? Like that's why I think in a community, in one respect, the ascetical impulses need to be amplified among those people for the sake of putting themselves in positions where they're able to carry real burdens for other people because they are not indulging. They're not enjoying goods for their own sake. They're renouncing goods in order to put them in a position where they can claim the better of love and service to God in these other ways, while recognizing that the goods that they're letting go of are really good. That's why they're letting go of them, right? Like it's not a renunciation of the goodness of the thing. It's an affirmation of the goodness. And which is why I think like Chesterton has this line about the Christian ascetics being peculiar in the sense that they had smiles on their faces, right? Versus other forms of ascetics, pagan types of ascetics, who didn't have smiles on their faces. The Christian ascetic who renounces these good things can have a smile because they recognize it's just because they're good that they're saying no to them. And there's just something better that's out there that they're holding themselves out for, that they're trying to discipline themselves into being and into enjoying. So I think the disposition of asceticism, Derek, your point is really well made about it being burdensome on certain people in church communities. But I actually think that that's why it needs to be present within those church communities in such a way that those who are of able body actually take it on disproportionately. Because otherwise, the sort of like imbalances between the goods that are enjoyed within a community becomes much more pronounced, right? If people with lots of goods are just constantly enjoying them and people without are not, that creates a very imbalanced condition within a community that I think is really problematic over the long term.
One of the things within your comments and also in Derek's that come to mind is the way in which we tend to approach any of these sorts of questions as modern democratic individualists. And we think about this as a sort of individual, private, spiritual heroism that we can take on for ourselves. And that also comes with all the questions of a certain type of self-righteousness, all the concerns of the Reformation against a practice that sets off a certain class of super Christians against anyone else. But at the same time, the comments that you had about community, Matt, I think tie into the question of how there can be an ascetical practice for the sake of the community and as a practice, a ministry of the community, not just private moral heroism, but the sense of part of our being there for each other is our commitment to engage in practices that make us more attentive to each other, make us more useful for each other, make us those who can be more compassionate towards each other. And that ability, when we're in good health, to suffer with those who suffer, to be able to go without and to experience something of the lack of food that our brothers and sisters experience, or to give ourselves more fully to the life of prayer when we have the opportunity for the sake of the good of the whole community. That, it seems to me, is something that is maybe lost. having a season of fasting where a small group of people who are able within the church give themselves to fasting and prayer is not private spiritual exertion so much as a practice of the community for the sake of the good of everyone.
Yeah, that's really helpful. I think part of it's really just hard to do that without setting up the heroic Christian versus average Christian dichotomy, like, you know, the councils of perfection and so on and so forth. It's hard to escape that tendency and that danger, especially when, and this is where I'll confess my ignorance of historic Lenten practices prior to the more kind of thick Roman penitential theology came in around it. But retrieving that without, I think this is a point that Matt's made before, without the communal enforcement of it being something that's required of all Christians to do without some sort of special dispensation, it's very hard, I think, to do this well in a community under modern conditions, under the contemporary conditions where everything is self-adopted and almost everything, the temptation of will worship hovers around everything in a condition where everything is optional and everything has to be submitted to freely or adopted or taken on. It's almost impossible to not turn it into my personal journey. It's the same reason that every Roman Catholic is a Protestant. In terms of the way that they submit to the Pope, there's just, you can't escape the individuality of your judgment to submit to the church at this point. And I think that is going to hover around any adoption of Lent at this point, that it's just, you have something to be massively aware of. And if you do this, you have to preach and teach very carefully around, otherwise, you know, yeah. So that's just one thing that worries me.
I think that's right, Derek. And it seems like it's a real challenge in part because of the loss of vicariousness and the sense that we are actually bound up together as members of the body, and what one member of the body does actually accrues to the rest of the body insofar as the rest of the body affirms what that member does, right? And this is one way in which the sort of two standard account, or the sort of like heroic, and we have the plebes, that vision of Christianity where you have two tiers of Christians, is one way in which Augustine, I think, avoids something like this. So he says, what one Christian does accrues to the whole body's virtue insofar as they affirm it through their wills. And so when one person fasts and the other person is incapable of fasting for whatever reason, but they affirm the other person in their fasting and they support them and pray for them and encourage them, actually the whatever the benefits are of the person fasting, whatever they accrue, actually comes to the person who prays for them and endorses their action. And that sense of vicariousness is just not present within our church communities. It's not a moral feature of our communities, and we don't have close enough bonds in many cases for it to be practically relevant to our decision-making. And I think that's a major problem that we would have to recover for something like ascetical practices to appropriately take root within Christian communities without being subject to the kind of concerns that you've rightly raised, Derek. We are not going to solve all of this. We're the podcast where we don't solve things. We raise questions and we have conversations and get all tangled up for 30 minutes and never get untangled, as one of our reviewers on iTunes has said. But we like it that way. That's what we do. And we enjoy the conversations with each other, and we enjoy hearing from you as well. So we're going to wrap it up there. This has been a terrific conversation, guys. Thanks for letting me work out some of my thoughts on this issue, which, of course, is on many Christians' minds because of Lent, but I think should be a more perennial subject of consideration for Christians and evangelicals particularly. We are going to be back in the weeks to come. I think we're going to talk with Jeremy Treat about atonement up next. Yay. Which and there was much rejoicing. Derek just issued the most half-hearted yay I think I've heard.
It's a good book. I actually I do love it. It's a great.
Derek just doesn't want to talk about the atonement.
I like it.
So that's
read
what
it.
That's what I'm taking away there. But we are going to talk about the atonement, regardless of what Derek wants. So we're going to do that, I think, next, and we don't know what's happening later this spring, but we're going to have other good conversations about the word of God in the world we live in. If you have listened and benefited from this, we would love it if you would rate and review us on iTunes. If you would spread the word, tell a friend. Mere Fidelity is more fun when it's listened to in communities with others. Do that. And do drop us a line through merefidelity.com. We read all of our mail, even if we do not respond. So we'll leave it there. Thanks for listening. Until next time, this has been Mere Fidelity.